Welcome to the Alt Swift X Game of Thrones Abridged podcast. This is episode 93, and today we're talking about the fifth Arya chapter in the second book of A Song of Ice and Fire, and it's going to be a good time. Thank you so much for joining us. I think it's going to be fun, because we're talking about the best character in A Song of Ice and Fire, Arya Stark, the Princess of Winterfell, who really, really has a bad time. She suffers. She has horrible, horrible things happen to her, and yet we can only love her for her persistence and resilience and adaptability in the face of any and all danger. At the same time as our heart breaks for what she's going through, the slow erosion of her identity, her separation from her family, all the heartbreaks that she suffers, which transform her into something very different to the way she was when she began. So thank you all so much for joining live or on the podcast. I remind you all that this is available as a podcast. Link is in the description of the YouTube video. You can get it direct to your device, which is exciting, on the internet. Or so I'm told. I just record these on cassette tapes. And then I send them in the post to my aunt, who encodes them via punch code, old school computer programming cardboard to the intertubes, and that's how this all works. It's a mystery to me, but I'm excited. So let's get into it. So Arya Stark, if y'all don't recall, and you'll be forgiven for not recalling, Arya Stark... She's just this guy, you know. She was this daughter of Ned Stark and Catelyn Stark, and she's like a tomboy. She's rebellious. She doesn't fit into the ladylike, feminine expectations of her society. And she was brought to King's Landing with her father when he was Hand of the King, but everything went tits up, tits sideways, tits diagonal, tits in every which way, because there was this whole sort of Lannister-Stark conflict vis-a-vis the death of King Robert. It's this whole thing. They should write a book about it. They should call it A Game of Thrones. There's my idea. You can thank me later. I'll just take 20% of the royalties. And so this whole sort of clusterfuck happened in book one. And then Arya hooked up with this bloke, Yoren. Hooked up in not that way, but the other way, to get to the north, to get to Winterfell. But that went badly, because a fella by the name of Armory Lorch attacked Yoren's crew, Yoren's squad, Yoren's entourage, the Men in Black. Not the kind that hunt aliens and mesmerize people in the pursuit of the cover-up with regards to the existence of aliens. No, not those Men in Black, but the Night's Watch, the fellas who were founded so many millennia ago in order to defend the realm from the White Walkers, or possibly actually in alliance with the White Walkers, sort of a marriage situation with the Night's King in order to make peace between the White Walkers and the humans. I don't want to blow your minds here. I don't want to go all ancient aliens on your asses this early into the episode, but I think it's possible that there was some kind of White Walker-human cooperation after the Long Night. Look up the Night Fort, guys. Look it up, nerds. Thanks for the super chat from Lucas Banavicious, which is an incredibly good name, who says, is Podrick's longsword the real Lightbringer? So if you're talking about his sausage of light, as the people of Little Fingers Broth will call it, it's not the real Lightbringer, it's better, or so I've been told. So Arya's crew was attacked by Armory Lorch's men. People died, it was a bad time, and she just barely survived. And it's a bit of a downer, but Arya is nothing if not adaptable, and she and her crew are doing their best to survive. So it is Arya, it is Gendry, it is Hot Pie, it is Lommy, it is Weasel, the awesome fivesome. I'll be perfectly honest, it's not the most capable and competent crew, but they do their best to survive, and that's what this chapter's about. And I'll tell you now, It gets worse. It goes from bad to worse. Well, actually, it already went... I mean, it was bad when Ned died, and it got worse when Yoren died. In this episode, it goes from worse to even worster. It's almost the worstest, which I believe is a kind of sausage, possibly a sauce. I'm no sauce linguist. You'll have to ask my cousin for that. He's a widely renowned sauce linguist. He majored in ranch. But anyway, we're going to talk about Arya 5. So we're on the first page. This is a relatively long chapter, so I think we'll try and do a lightning round. We're going to be fast. We're going to be furious. We're going to be wha-wha-wha. You're not going to know what's hit you. So if I'm too blindingly concise, apologies in advance. If you get too much knowledge in too short a time, I mean, what can I say? Write a letter to the editor, you know? Do some skywriting. I want you to write on the sky, "Oh, ShiftX, he's too fast." Well, look, that's why they've got a button on YouTube, and indeed on your favorite podcast app, to play back in like half speed, 25 speed. That's how fast I'm going to be speeding. You can call me a speed racer, all right? Call me Speed Racer. Call me The Flash. Call me your ex, because I'm just going to finish this thing before you've even begun to listen. So it's going to be a great time. So the first sentence of this chapter is... "When she climbed all the way up to the highest branch, Arya could see chimneys poking through the trees." So what's happening is that Arya and the squad and the crew, they're in a bad situation, and they're hungry and they're lost, and they're checking out this village that they've found. They're near the God's Eye Lake, which is where Yoren and the crew were attacked, and so she's scoping out this village, trying to work out what's going on, which is like good instincts, right? I mean, need I remind you that Arya is 10 years old in this second book, and yet she has some great survival instincts. For someone who's been like namby-pambied and coddled and modeled in a castle for all her life, Arya has excellent survival instincts. So she climbs a tree. She's shimmying, she's skinnying, she's rolling up in sidey-wideys, she's got the ghillie suit on, a weirwood ghillie suit for extra magic. Well, no, that's a lie, but she's doing some scouting, it's great, and she's ooh, there's boats, there's a pier, there's a stable, she's like, you know when like those shitty like Assassin's Creed, Far Cry games, you know how there's like dozens of these games that are all the same, and you like take over the outposts, and you climb the towers to reveal the map, and you collect the feathers to get the thing, and then you got to pay $99.99 of DLC to get the extra hat. Shitty video games. It's like that. She's like scoping out all the fellas. Fellascope. That's what I call the game I'm developing. Fellascope. It's a triple entendre. Okay, listen. So Arya's scoping out the village. She's climbing up the tree, and it looks bad. It actually looks promising, this village. But Arya then thinks back, and she's like, "All right, I've looked at other villages, and they've all been bad. It's been empty and desolate. Farms, villages, castles, septs, barns. It made no matter. If it could burn, the Lannisters had burned it. If it could die, they'd killed it. They had even set the woods ablaze where they could, though the leaves were still green and wet from recent rains and the fires had not spread." So there's like a few takes from that sentence. I could go on with this particular sentence. But first of all, this is obviously highlighting the horror and destruction and devastation wrought by this war that the Lannisters have been raiding the Riverlands in response to, firstly in response to Ned fighting Jaime and Catelyn capturing Tyrion, and then in response, of course, to Robb crowning himself king and rebelling against the throne and warring against the Lannisters. It's hilarious that, I mean, supposedly it's the Baratheons who are king, but it's the Lannisters who are running the show with Cersei and Tywin and whatnot. So, you know, the Lannisters are waging this terrible, unjust war of scorched earth and killing civilians against the Riverlands. But we've got to remember that, like, just a couple of chapters ago, we were from the point of view of our good mate Tyrion Lannister, and we were cheering and rejoicing as poor Tyrion Lannister got his jollies by wielding political power in King's Landing and finally getting all jiggy with the real politic. But when we actually consider what the Lannister regime is doing in the Riverlands and elsewhere, this is a horrible, unethical, destructive regime that is wreaking destruction all over the place. So should we cheer when Tyrion works for that regime? When Tyrion reinforces the bastard, psychotic king, Joffrey Baratheon, should we be happy about his successes? Should we be happy that Tyrion defeats Stannis at the Battle of the Blackwater later in this book? Is that really a good thing for Westeros or for anything? Tyrion is so goddamn pleased with himself. But now we have Arya on the ground, seeing what's really happening on an individual, personal level, outside of the ivory tower of King's Landing, and it's a goddamn nightmare. So that invites us to question whether Tyrion really is such a good guy. I think what's fantastic about A Song of Ice and Fire is that it puts us in the head of so many different characters who have so many different perspectives on the same situation. And that makes us realize that everyone is blinkered. Everyone only sees their small slice of the world through their own small perspective. And you can never understand the whole so long as we are trapped in our own individual perspective. And so that's what's wonderful about being able to see this story from so many viewpoints. The Lannisters are burning everything. But also, I think it's interesting that they're talking about the woods. They're talking about the green woods, which is important because we're on the God's Eye Lake. This is a special, significant lake because on the God's Eye Lake is the Isle of Faces, this special, sacred, magical, magical, old gods island with all these weirwood trees on it. And legend says it's inhabited by the Green Men, who are some kind of mysterious antlered cult of old gods magic, with what with the weirwooding and the green seeing and the skin changing. Very, very mysterious. I mean, I don't really understand how something so mysterious can be on the Isle of Faces. Like, it's not like it would be hard to go and take a boat over and check out what the fuck is the deal. Like, wouldn't the people in King's Landing be like, why do we have this hippie cult on our doorstep? Is this normal? Should we check this out? I don't know. But the Isle of Faces is right there, like this locus of old gods' power and magic in the south. And there's some interesting speculation about the Isle of Faces. Like, in the TV show Game of Thrones, which you might have heard of, I don't recommend it wholeheartedly, but there is a TV show, and in that TV show, Bran Stark becomes King of Westeros. Spoilers. And it's weird the way that happens in the TV show. Bran just like scoots on in and he's like, holla at your boy. It's Big B Ran coming at you from the throne. I'm the king, deal with it. Sunglasses, scoots off. And you know, mixed feelings about that, I would say mixed feelings about King Bran, but the books might also be going in that direction. It's been said by the showrunners of the Game of Thrones TV show that that will also happen in the books. But I suspect it'll happen differently. Just like the burning of King's Landing, I think it will also happen in the books. It'll just happen differently. And I think that maybe Bran Stark being a green seer connected to the magic of the old gods is going to be in a very different context. And some people speculate in the fandom that Bran Stark will rule from the God's Eye or from the Isle of Faces, or at least that the Isle of Faces will play some role with Bran Stark. Because one of the weirdest fucking things about the TV show was that Bran's like this green seer king, and they put the three-eyed crow on the armor of the Kingsguard in Game of Thrones season 8 episode 6, which it's been said, but it's fucking odd. It is right proper weird, because people in the South have no fucking idea what a three-eyed raven is, or indeed a three-eyed crow, which is what it is in the books. What is the old gods to the South? It makes no sense. But here's the thing. The Isle of Faces is the locus of Old God's power in the south. The Isle of Faces is where the Weirwoods are, it's where the Old God's magic is, it's where the Antler Green Men are. So surely, if Bran Stark will be a king in the south, the Isle of Faces has to be where he is coronated, where he rules from, where he sees from. It's the veritable fucking Amon Hen of the south, right? So I would think it will play a role. And also, like, you know, Bran Stark, he's got this timey-wimey David Tennant vibes, what with the time travel, and he may exert that power through the power of ravens, because Bran, as a green seer and a skin changer, can enter the mind of birds and watch what's going on, like kind of a mystical, supernatural TiVo through the eyes of birds. And I think it's interesting that there are so many birds in this chapter, since they're right next to, you know, like they're literally walking along the shores of the God's Eye in this chapter, right by the Isle of Faces. So whenever there's birds mentioned in this chapter, I'm like, could there possibly be some old gods Brano vision? Could Brano be scoping out the story from the future via the skin changing? So keep that in mind when the burbs come, indeed, Kelly. All right. I'm mostly ignoring the live chat because, you know, your memes are, they're fiery, but I can only look at so many things at once. All right. We're on page one. Let's keep it moving. So, here's a cool thing. So they're talking about how when they escaped, after, like, Yoren was attacked by Armory Lorch and everything went tits sideways, they burned everything. Armory Lorch and his men, they burned the town where Yoren and his people were taking cover. And they burned everything, and it burned so brightly that the lake, the God's Eye, it almost looked like the lake was a fire. Which I think is interesting, sort of like elemental imagery, right? Like the water is a fire. This song is called A Song of Ice and Fire. There's all sorts of elemental magic, so what with the drowned god, and with R'hllor, and with the fucking, who's Nymeria's mates? The Rhoynar, and like the water magic, and the water wizards. Like Song of Ice and Fire isn't like as magical, as overtly magical as your bloody Wheels of Timeses and your Aragons. You know, there's no codified system of magic, but there's magic in this world. There's elemental magic. And I think this idea of the lake being a fire is evocative. Especially given that, like, war crimes are cringe, says Dion in the chat. I agree. No, but especially considering that this lake, the God's Eye, is where Harrenhal was built, this giant castle built by Harren the Black, this despotic ironborn who took over the Riverlands. And Harrenhal was burned by Aegon Targaryen riding Balerion the Black Dread, the biggest dragon in the history of A Song of Ice and Fire, this gigantic biblical Sodom-Gomorrite conflagration that consumed Harrenhal and melted it like candles, this biblical fire that rained upon the God's Eye. And it seems as though that is being echoed now by this evocation of fire on the God's Eye, you know? That's pretty dank. I'd give that 8 danks out of 8. So elemental magic, which I think will be relevant in the Winds of Winter. Like, all these chess pieces, magical and otherwise, have been put into place throughout the series. And I think a lot of the magical elements will really come to the fore in Winds of Winter. Like, Euron Greyjoy, obviously, with his blood magic, sacrificial, pocker gunderfuck that's happening against the Red Wine Fleet. That's going to get gnarly. All of Daenerys and Jon and Azor Ahai and Lightbringer. I think we're going to see a lot of magic. And so I really like this lake being a fire. It also reminds me of, remember when Jojen Reed and Mira Reed arrive at Winterfell in book 2? And they swear fealty to the Starks, and they swear by earth and water, by bronze and iron, by ice and fire. And that's one of the very few moments in the series that actually name drops this concept of ice and fire, this sort of elemental dualistic vibe that they're going for. Earth and water, bronze and iron. And I wonder if we'll see more of those sorts of concepts in the Winds of Winter. Bronze is associated with, like, the First Men, with their more prehistoric technology before the Andals came. And iron is really interesting because it's in opposition to the White Walkers. It's we're told in one of the books that the White Walkers, the others, fear iron, and that's why the men in the crypts, the statues in the crypts, have iron swords, which repel the White Walkers, apparently, because fairies in real-world mythology fear iron. And I think George Martin is drawing from that real-life folklore to make the others afraid of iron. And I wonder how that will play out when the White Walker apocalypse happens. So, all sorts of elemental, interesting stuff going on, and the town that Arya scoped out. Once they left that town that they were in with Yoren, it was a nightmare. Blackened stones, shells of houses, corpses, and smoke was all that remained. Okay, so that was page one of this chapter. I think we'll try and pick up the pace. Oh, Dougie. So, they left the town that was burned by Armory Lorch, and everyone was killed once they emerged from their hidey hole. They went up like a watchtower that they were hiding in, and Arya didn't leave the town until she found the corpse of Yoren. She didn't want to, like, her mates were like, let's GTFO to the E to the I to the P, Eep? No. But like Gendry and Lommy were like, let's make like a tree and get the fuck out of here. You know I love Back to the Future references. But Arya was like, no, I won't leave until I find Yoren. Because Arya has this enormous loyalty and she has this enormous hope. Arya really wants to believe that her friends will be there for her. And they never fucking are. That's the tragedy of Darth Arya the Wise. All her hope, all her loyalty, is never rewarded. And that's what's so sad about Arya's whole story. So Arya's like, no, Yoren is tough, Yoren is hard, Yoren is a man of the Night's Watch. He will have survived. I'm sure he'll still be alive. But her loyalty and hope is only rewarded with death, disappointment, disillusion, and other D words, because the axe blow that killed Yoren had split his skull apart. And Lorch didn't bother to bury Yoren or his own men. Armory Lorch is such a piece of shit. We don't really know much about Armory Lorch, but like everything that he does is a terrible thing. Like he murdered Rhaenys Targaryen, the like infant daughter, the toddler daughter of Elia Martell and Rhaegar Targaryen, stabbed her 50 times. And then he burns and attacks all these like innocent civilians. Armory Lorch is one of those characters with no redeeming qualities. And he does get his comeuppance when he gets torn into 5 different pieces by Viggo Hoat. But I don't know. I always feel a bit conflicted about George Martin's more one note characters. His like totally unequivocally evil characters. Because one of the things I love most about A Song of Ice and Fire is that it takes characters like Cersei and Jaime, who seem like horrible people at first, and then we get inside their heads, and we understand why they are the way they are, and we become a lot more sympathetic for them. And Cersei is still a horrible person, and Jaime is a bit less of a horrible person, but at least we understand why, you know? And so I think it maybe gives a bit of a disservice to that idea, the fact that Armory Lorch is... You know, Armory Lorch and Gregor Clegane and Joffrey Baratheon and Ramsay Bolton are still irredeemable pieces of shit, you know? Doesn't that sort of undermine the humanizing message of the other characters like Cersei and Jaime? But, you know, I guess George Martin's thesis, George Martin's argument is that some people are irredeemable. And I don't know, like, personally, I don't think that's quite the case. Like, I think that some people do have a net negative impact on the world, for sure, but I think that everyone has reasons. You know, cause and effect, if nothing else. We're all fucking pool balls on a table, if nothing else. And I think that it would help if we sort of understood, well, why is Ramsay Bolton such a piece of shit? You know, Roose tells us that it's in his blood, the bad blood of a bastard. But I think that saying that someone is inherently bad because of their blood is sad and hashtag problematic. Possibly true. I don't know. But thank you for the super chat from Addy the Hun, who says, binging this series kept me sane this year, so thanks. Thanks so much, Addy. I think we'll try and do more episodes more frequently, because you're right. It's in times, in any times, it's a good idea to do a bit of shifting. So, Arya insisted on looking for Yoren, and she finds his corpse, and Armory Lorch has laid waste to this place. And Arya sort of mourns Yoren. She thinks he was going to take me home. He was going to bring me safe to Winterfell. Part of her wanted to cry, and the other part wanted to kick him. So Arya's heartbroken that this chance and this hope of going to Winterfell and her family, because that's all she ever fucking wants. All Arya ever wants is a home and friends and family and the most basic fucking foundations on Maslow's pyramid, you know? But she never fucking gets it, despite her efforts. She puts as much effort into getting home and getting what she needs as anyone does, but she doesn't get it. And injustice is one of the themes of this story and of this chapter. You know, people like Cersei does nothing but fucking gargle Hippocras and her brother's bits, and yet she gets just about everything that she wants most of the time. At least, you know, she lives very fucking comfortably compared to Arya, who literally eats worms and bugs. Arya fights so hard and went so far, but in the end, but it doesn't work very well, you know? So yeah, it's a fucking nightmare, but she's sad. And they talk about how they, like, hid in this watchtower while Armory Lorch was burning everything. There are these some of Yoren's other men called Cutjack and Kurz and some other bloke. They were taking shelter along with Arya, Lommi, Hotpie, Gendry, and this girl, Weasel. And Arya's looking back in the tree, back in the present. She's scoping out this village, hoping to find something useful. She's being very cautious. She waits in the tree for a long time. Arya's really disciplined. Arya's like 10 years old, but she's super disciplined and tough. And despite all her efforts, she gets captured anyway. And yeah, the air is full of birds. And then it mentions the God's Eye Lake. And I think it's so interesting that they're evoking the birds next to the God's Eye of the old gods. You know, is it possible that Bran Stark is watching them right now through the wargs of the wargy yorgs, through the flappy friends? You know what I'm saying? And she looks at the lake and she's like, the lake is calling to me. She wants to leap into the placid blue waters, to feel clean, but she dares not to take off her clothes where the others would see. So Arya is trying to hide the fact that she's a girl. She's trying to hide the fact that she's Arya Stark for the sake of her survival. And it's so sad that Arya, along with everything else she suffers, she has to hide who she really is. That's one of the central ongoing themes of Arya's story, is that in order to survive, she needs to hide her identity. And we learn the cost of hiding your identity. If you don't know who you are, if you don't have your family, if you don't have your name, then who the fuck are you? And that really wears Arya down. And so the cruelty of not being able to be herself, as well as being deprived of everything else, is a bad time. And Arya is hardened. She's walking barefoot because her boots turn to shit, and so her blisters break and her cuts heal and her soles turn to leather, which might as well be a metaphor for like her entire arc. Like, Arya's whole arc is about how she starts as this innocent, happy, adventurous kid, and she gets slowly deformed and eroded into this skeletal, cold killer, deprived of the identity that once defined her. She loses everything that she was, and she becomes, quote-unquote, no one. So goddamn, it's a rough arc. So she's hardened, she's leather, she's tough. And she looks at the swans who are swimming around on the lake. And no one told the swans that the war had come. The swans are chillin', They're gliding, they're puffing L's, they're having a great time. They're laying back. They got one of those inflatable donuts. They're just, like, having margaritas on the water. These fucking geese don't care what's up. And so it invites us to think that, man, wow, maybe the nature is better than man. Look, human beings give ourselves a lot of credit for, you know, technology, New York, the United Nations. But the dolphins say that they're better than the humans for the same reasons. Because they didn't inflict anyone with New York or the United Nations. You know what I'm saying? The geese, they keep it real. Keep it real, like a goose. That's my advice. Put that on a t-shirt. So, you know, maybe nature's better. That was sort of mentioned in one of the previous Aya chapters. You know, the dragonflies just flitting around, having a good time. Maybe we should all just be flitting around like dragonflies, and then the world wouldn't be so fucked. We wouldn't have, like, insulin then, though, so that would be a downer. Anyway, so the swans are swanning around, and I'm like, well, hang on, Aya becomes a warg later on. Like, Aya skin changes into a katu later on. A good old neko. Is that the word for cat? Neko? I don't know. Aya's a warg. If Aya really wanted to, she could just warg into a swan and just stay a swan, right? Because, like, we learned from the Varamyr prologue chapter in A Dance with Dragons that a warg can just enter an animal's mind and stay there. If Aya really, really tried, she could just warg into this swan and just swan around for the rest of her existence. That might be better than what she's about to suffer in the motherfucking House of Black and White. Goddamn. So, maybe she should. But she doesn't. So, she's surviving off acorn paste and bugs and worms. That's how bad it's going. She's spending days and days, like, just walking around in the God's Eye. And, like, spoiler, before Uber Eats, before motherfucking Menulog, back in the days, if you didn't have some Walmart to pick up your fucking Kellogg's Nutri-Grain, you had to eat worms, boy. That was what you had. So that's what you did. You ate some worms. That's all you had. And I love that, you know, Arya's a princess of Winterfell. She's the sister of King Robb Stark. And here she is, slurping down worms like it ain't no thing, which is crazy. I always wonder, like, you know, what if Sansa was in this situation? Like, Arya mentions that, you know, Arya, back at home, she ate a bug just to make Sansa screech. And so that sort of prepared her for eating bugs now. But I wonder, like, you know, Sansa lives off fucking lemon cakes and sunshine. I wonder how she would react if she was in this position. I think that she would do what Lommy is suggesting and just yield to the Lannisters immediately. And I wonder what Arya would do if she was in Sansa's situation. I don't suspect that she would play along with the Lannisters. I think she'd keep on trying to escape and to fight until they put her in the bloody black cells. I don't think that'd do terribly well. So she's eating bugs, and centipedes are the good ones. I would put roly-polies are like the S-tier bug food. Centipedes are like A, but you got to make sure they don't bite back. Ladybugs are B-tier. They're not as delicious as they'd look, but they do have a distinct sort of strawberry vibe. I would say that dung beetles, don't be put off by the name, but dung beetles, they've got some meat on them. They are some beefy boys, those dung beetles. So I would recommend. Cockroaches, true to their name, not delicious. Cockroaches are some D-tier bug food, in my opinion. Anyway, turning the page. So, Hot Pie found some blackberries. They got on the berry scene. Kurz taught them how to make acorn paste. So Kurz was one of these other guys who was in Yoren's bunch of Night's Watch recruits, and Kurz died because he got a wound during the fight with Armory Lorch, and he died of the wound, and he was dead. And then the other two blokes from Yoren's squad, Tarba and Cutjack, they left. They said they went hunting, but they just abandoned. They abandoned Arya, Gendry, Hot Pie, Lommy, and Weasel. Which is a pretty fucking horrible thing to do. Arya says she hates these guys for leaving. And it is cold, you know. Tarba and Kutjak, these are adult men, I'm presuming. And they just leave. And they leave Aya and Hotpie and Lommy and Gendry and Weasel to their fate. Which seems like such a horrible thing to do. Because these are like children, you know. They're probably going to die without bloody Tarba and Kutjak. And yet they leave. And, you know, I mean, maybe they were right. Because, like, one of the things that keeps coming up in this chapter is that, like, you know, Aya says that, well, Gendry says that, hey, Lommy is wounded, he's going to die, we should leave him. And Lommy says that, fucking, like people are doing this calculus of survival. Sometimes you got to be cold, you got to be ruthless in order to survive. And, you know, maybe you can't blame Tarba and Kutjak, because indeed, at the end of this chapter, spoiler, Aya and Hotpie and Gendry get captured. So maybe Tarba and Kutjak were right to leave them, you know? Song of Ice and Fire puts you in all these uncomfortable moral positions where you're like, well, maybe people do have to do bad things to survive, because God knows Eddard Stark should have. So, they're chilling, they're killing. Aya's thinking, ooh, a water dancer never falls, as she climbs the tree. She's thinking of Syrio Forel. And Aya is really resenting the fact that Tarba and Kutjak left them. She hates them for leaving. And that's one of the consistent themes in Aya's chapter, is that, like, all she fucking wants, she wants a home, she wants a pack, she wants people she can rely on. But Tarba and Kutjak leave her. And then Hotpie leaves her, and then Gendry leaves her. And no matter what Aya does, the people she wants to rely on and be with leave her. Which is so fucking sad. And she ends up in this death cult, because no one else will have her. It's so sad. And then Aya climbs down the tree after scoping out the village, and Weasel comes out of the forest. Weasel is this little girl. They don't know her name. She doesn't talk, but they call her Weasel. And Aya notices that there's mud, there's, like, around her mouth, and Aya hopes that she hasn't been eating mud, because they're fucking starving. These are, like, children. They have no food. They're eating mud and worms and shit. This is a badass situation. Not badass in the good way, but in the bad way, all right? Bad badass. And it sucks. So Weasel, like, clings to Aya, and Aya thinks, sometimes she did that now. Which is kind of a detached response to this little kid, like, desperately clutching at you for survival and affection. So, you know, it's not like Aya has a great outpouring of protective or maternal feelings for this girl. But, you know, she does look out for Weasel. And Hotpie is like, hey, we should yield to the Lannisters, then we'll be fine. And they talk about how Lommy is injured, because during the fight with Armory Lord, she got a spear through the leg and he has to limp, and then it's getting infected. And they built a litter out of tree branches to carry Lommy around. So, like, they're doing the right thing. They're trying to help out Lommy, but, like, I think Tarba and Kutjak might have been right that these guys are fucking dead weight, because Lommy is really slowing them down. But here's the thing, like, when you're the most weak and vulnerable, you gotta look after the other weak and vulnerable, because who else fucking will? Song of Ice and Fire is a story about power, and sometimes the people who are powerful, look after themselves, because they've got the power to do so. And sometimes the only people who will look after the weak and vulnerable are the other weak and vulnerable. It's almost like we need some kind of, like, an organized system, like, call, you know, like a state, or like a government, to, like, provide support to the vulnerable. Like maybe we should have that, like a state that, like, provides care to the people who need care, because often the people with power won't. Like, what, maybe we should, maybe, anyway. So, they're talking about yielding and whatever, and, like, maybe they fucking should have yielded, honestly, because they only get captured anyway. But anyway, so Gendry's like, I don't think we should yield, because knights and lordlings only care about themselves. They don't care about peasants like us if we yield. And so Gendry's, you know, complaining about the horrors of the class system. Gendry's complaining that when you're a peasant, the High Lords don't care about you. Which is hilarious, because Gendry is, of course, the son of King Robert. It looks like we had a stream connection issue, but it's back, so no worries. As soon as you say something untoward, you get cut off, hey? Anyway, so they're talking about that shit, and then turn page. And then Hotpie's like, yo, listen up, I got some fishy facts to drop. I'm gonna slither in like a Slytherin and drop you some marine knowledge. So Hot Pie says, hey, that's a fishing village. If that's a fishing village, they got fish. Here's the thing about fish. Ooh, you can eat them. You can sell them. You can buy them. You can eat them some more. I'm motherfucking Hot Pie. Out of the deal, okay? I got a keen eye for commerce. I can spot a deal from a million miles. Whoa! Hot Pie, coming at you. That's what Hot Pie says. There's this really great character there's a kids series called Gone by Michael Grant, and it's about like these kids who get trapped in this sort of dome situation. It's like some Hunger Games sort of shit. It's like all these kids trapped in a space doing some, Lord of the Flies. And there's this one character in the Gone series who is sort of an entrepreneur. He's got an eye for a deal, and he like co-opts the Monopoly coin prizes that were in McDonald's Happy Meals once and turns them into a currency for this post-apocalyptic Lord of the Flies society. And it's a good time. It's cool. He's a really cool character in this series. But I don't know. I'm just getting slight vibes of that character from Hot Pie. Because I love how Hot Pie, you know, his barter skill is high. So anyway, like, Arya's like, man, I wish we could catch some of these fish, but fish are quicker than pigeons and quicker than cats, so Arya can't catch them. And it's like, well, you know, Arya could just warg those fishes. Like, I know that she hasn't leveled up her magic skill high enough yet, but Arya could just warg into the fishes and then warg those fishes right down into her belly if she wants to. I assume you want to warg out of the fish before it gets digested, but like, come on, you could walk into a fish. If you can walk into a cat, you can walk into a fish. Come on. What was that line? If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a dodgeball. That's true of walking as well. So anyway, Gendry's looking fierce. His beard has grown out a bit. And he's looking like his father, Robert Baratheon. Fierce, with a black beard. Everyone's hungry, they're complaining. And Arya thinks about a family, Rob and Jon and so on, and she's thinking about how Rob and John and Eddard used to hunt boar in the Wolf's Wood, and she never got to go on the boar hunts, because boar hunting is not for ladies, and of course the irony is that Arya is now surviving off those unladylike skills that she was prohibited from participating in. So take that, Septa Mordain. And Arya thinks it's funny that when Gendry is trying to think, he looks pained when he tries to think, like it hurts him something fierce. And like father, like son, right? Robert Baratheon is not big on thinking either. So they're thinking maybe we can steal some food from this village, because Lommy used to be a thief in King's Landing. And Arya points out that if Lommy was such a good thief, he wouldn't have got bloody caught and thrown into the cells in King's Landing. And Lommy and Gendry are like, well, Arya should go and sneak into this village, because Arya's all sneaky-like. And they talk about how there's wolves in the forest, which Arya heard. Maybe her direwolf Nymeria is out there. And Arya had heard these wolves, and Lommy's like, get me some leg potion, mate. My leg hurts, what with the wound, it's a bit of a problem. I need some leg potion to heal my leg. And, you know, common misconception about leg potion, there's not just one kind. You've really got, you've got your left leg potion, you got your right leg potion, and woe betide you if you get them confused. My uncle once lost a leg, several legs in the Boer War, and when he accidentally took a left leg potion when he should have taken a right leg potion, he grew entirely the wrong leg. And now his the toes on his legs, they're asymmetrical. He's got like big toe, little toe, little toe, little toe, little toe, big toe, little toe, little toe, little toe, little toe, when it should be like the big toe next to the big toe, you know? Anyway, so watch out for your leg potions is what I'm telling you. And then Lommy's like, Weasel keeps kicking me. And then Gendry's like, I'll kick you. There's a lot of kicking talk in this chapter. I'm not sure why. But they're like, all right, we're going to check out this village. We're going to find some shit. It's going to be great. And then Gendry and Arya walk off to the village to find some stuff. And Gendry says, I think Lommy's going to die. And Arya has a sort of like a cold reaction, because like Lommy's wounded, you know, he's getting worse. He needs his leg potion. But Arya's like, I'm not surprised. you know, Kurz, this man, Kurz had died of his wound. So Lommi will probably die of his wound as well. And it's really startling that this, like, young girl, Arya, has to, like, engage in this cold, rational life or death calculus, you know, at such a young age. She's having to think coldly about people having to die because of this harsh survival situation that she's thrust into. And so she's like, yeah, you know, I guess, you know, maybe Lommi will die. I mean, if we could find a maester, it'll be all right. Because my mate Maester Lewin back at Winterfell, he would have helped anyone who would come to him. And so despite all this horror, Arya does have this intense hope and optimism for the goodness of humanity. Someone like Maester Lewin will save them. But Arya's indefatigable hope and optimism is slowly, torturously crushed throughout her story arc, which is what makes her story so sad. And so Gendry's like, look, we should just leave Lommi behind, because we can't fucking carry him around all the time. He's gonna die anyway. He's complaining, he's no use to anyone, we should let Lommi die. And this is a bit like that, you know, like that philosophical thought experiment called the trolley problem. It's like the trolley problem, but it's the Lommi problem. Like, if there was like a dozen Lommies tied up on a train track in front of you, but there was only one Lommi tied up on the other track, would you change the tracks to run over one Lommi instead of running over 50 Lommies? Of course you would. Of course you would. 50 Lommies are more important than one Lommi, you know? So maybe we should let this Lommi die, so that Gendry and Arya and Weasel and Hoppeye can survive, you know? That's a real philosophical head-scratcher for you right there, I would think. So, yeah, really rough philosophical problems that we've got here. And Gendry says, oh, and, like, BTW, like, I've realized that you're a girl. Like, Arya at this point is pretending to be Arya the orphan boy, but she's not. She's a girl. She's Arya Stark, and Gendry has finally noticed. So it turns out Gendry is not as stupid as Arya thinks. He's a bit more observant. He's noticed that Arya keeps going into the woods to make her water. She's not pissing cocks out for the boys like everyone else. And so Arya's like, no, I'm a boy. I'm a boy. And Gendry's like, well, prove it. Pull out your cock and prove it. And Arya's like, yeah, nah, all right. Honestly, not a boy. I'm a girl. I'm a real girl. I'm Arya Stark of Winterfell. I mean, before she says that, she's like, well, maybe I should murder Gendry. Like, I could pull out Needle, and I could kill Gendry where he stood, or else I could trust him. So Arya's always in this constant, difficult calculus of, can I trust people, or should I kill? And most of the time, it turns out that Arya should kill. That's what serves her survival most of the time, tragically. But in this moment, Arya confides in Gendry, and she says that, yeah, I'm Arya, I'm from House Stark, and I'm trying to get back home. And Gendry's like, what the fuck? You're a lady of Winterfell? You live in a castle? You were a lord's daughter? Oh my god, I should have never talked about cocks in front of you. Gendry is uncertain, almost afraid. Which is like, holy hell, like, a class system is a hell of a drug, right? Like, for this big, tough 15-year-old boy to be afraid of this tiny little 10-year-old girl because of a class system, you know? Some arbitrary blood-based system that makes some people more important than others. And Gendry is suddenly sort of afraid of Arya. But she doesn't look like a lady because she's got dirt under her nails and she's got scabs on her elbows. Septim Ordain wouldn't even know me. My mother's a lady and my sister was a lady, but I never was. So that whole sort of gender normative social role that Arya never quite fit. And so Gendry insists that, oh, look, I know my manners. If someone who's highborn comes at me, I will bend the knee and speak only when spoken to and call you my lady. And, you know, of course, the irony of Gendry being so cowed by the whole sort of social system is that Gendry is the goddamn son of King Robert. But he doesn't know that yet. So, so they're talking about how Arya is actually Arya Stark. And Arya's like, huh, I'm going to kick you. And Gendry's like, what the hell sort of lord's daughter are you? And Arya says, this kind. So Arya's very, very forthright and bold about being the sort of person who she is and rejecting the sort of social role that she has. Not that it's bad to fit the social role that you're given. You're also allowed to do that. And it can also be cool that Arya defies the social role that she's assigned. Both kinds are cool. Anyway, so they approach the town and Arya smells dead men and it's all very ominous, this village that they're approaching. They're trying to find food or something. And there's a gibbet, which I always thought a gibbet sounds like a fun word. A gibbet should be a word for something good. But a gibbet, it's not a kind of a monkey. It's a wooden structure that's built to hold dead people. The Lannisters have killed a bunch of people and they are rotting on this gibbet, and crows are pecking at their flesh and flapping from corpse to corpse. And you know, we speculated before that maybe these crows are somehow inhabited by the old gods and by the magic of the Weirwoods, and maybe even by Bran. And so it's confronting that these crows are, like, eating the flesh of dead men and doing this really sort of dark, horrible thing. But, of course, remember that, like, the old gods, we are reminded in the World of Ice and Fire world book that, like, that the old gods eat people, motherfucker. The old gods took blood sacrifice. The first men would hang corpses from trees. Bran Stark has a vision of someone's throat being opened with a bronze blade before the roots of a weirwood in Winterfell. Like, the old gods are hardcore. They're OG. They kill cunts. And so we should not be surprised to see crows by the god's eye eating corpses. There's a darkness there, and Bran sups from that darkness. Whether or not Jojen was mashed up like a Fruity Loop and put in that weirwood paste, the old gods are dark, and Bran drinks from that dark magic. Polarity Jones in the chat says, is weirwood sap just human blood? And maybe it is. Because the weirwoods, the consciousness of the weirwoods is green seers, and perhaps all old gods worshippers whose souls and spirits have entered the weirwood network as a hive mind on the moment of their deaths. And if they are powered by the souls of the dead, like the goddamn emperor in 40K, then maybe indeed their sap is just pure human blood. Goddamn. So Arya's looking at these corpses, and she notices that it's not just the crows eating the corpses, it's also something else, something much larger, which I suppose means wolves. And I wonder if one of those wolves might be Nymeria. There's a constant presence of wolves throughout this chapter, and I wonder if Arya's ex-direwolf Nymeria might be one of them. So, looking at the gibbet, someone in the chat says it's pronounced gibbet, but I insist on pronouncing it as gif, not jif, so I think I'll continue to say gibbet. Anyway, so they're looking at the corpses, and Arya's trying to be tough and cold, and she notices that these corpses hanging on the gibbet, they hardly look like people at all, which I think speaks to this idea that death is dehumanizing. Like, I mean, literally, right? Like, when you are dead, you are no longer a person. That's how we see it anyway. Once a person is a corpse, that corpse is no longer a person anymore. Once someone's dead, you can do whatever. You can stick them, slice them, put them in a stew, right? Like a potato. Corpse is dead, not a person anymore. And so the act of killing is dehumanizing. It removes the humanity from someone. But here's the thing. Hot take. You ready for this? Killing a person, it not only removes the humanity from the victim, it removes humanity from yourself. Whew. Hashtag too deep for you. Because that's what happens to Arya, right? Every time she kills, every time Arya removes the humanity from a person, she also removes the humanity from herself. Because Arya's identity, Arya's sensitivities, Arya's human connections, which are what make us human, is our connections, is worn away every time she kills. Indeed, I'm 14 and that's deep. But I think that's what George is kind of going for. Death is dehumanizing, and that's what the Faceless Men represent. But Arya tries to say brave, Fear cuts deeper than swords, she says, channeling Sirio, and she thinks, dead men cannot hurt me. Except, of course, dead men can hurt, as John learns. The whites are these zombies that come out and kill people, so death is something to be afraid of. Of course, in Game of Thrones Season 8, the TV show, Arya fights whites. She fights zombies, and she has this very sort of interesting dance with death, where she almost gets killed by whites, by zombies. And so Arya's relationship with death is something that is continually developed and explored. And it takes two to tango, you know? Arya kills, death kills. Arya and death are in this constant circling each other. It's like a romance, Arya and death. I hope they break up, but they may never disentangle themselves. So Arya is like sneaking up on this village, trying to see what's what, and Gendry gets captured. Gendry gets captured by the Lannisters, and Arya thinks, stupid, 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 you stupid. And she wants to kick him again. And that's bad. And they take Gendry's helmet. And later on, when Arya gets captured, the Lannisters take Arya's sword as well, Needle. And somehow that's like the most enraging part of this goddamn chapter. Gendry is stripped of his helm, and Arya is stripped of Needle, because those things are their identities, right? Like Gendry is called the Bull. He wears this bull helmet. That's the identity that he forged for himself. And Needle is the identity. Like Arya, like Arya thinks that Needle is Winterfell. Needle is Jon and Ned and whatever. So somehow being stripped of their identity is what's most horrifying. It's almost like, you know, the dead man, they lose their humanity. They become not people anymore. And indeed, losing Needle, losing the bull's helmet is somehow the worst part. And so Arya looks at the banner at this town, and she notices that it's dogs, because this town is controlled by Gregor Clegane's men, the Hound's brother, the mountain that rides. And of course, Arya will become very familiar with Sandor Clegane, the mountain's brother, in the next book. And so Arya's like, well, Gendry's a fucking idiot, but I've got to help him. I've got to save him. So Arya has this intense loyalty. And of course, if Arya was smart, she'd just fucking leave these other motherfuckers and she'd probably survive fine by herself. But she's trying to be loyal. She's trying to be good. And yet that loyalty is what gets her captured. She tries to save Gendry. She gets captured. So it's like, you know, we go back to the Lommy problem. We go back to the trolley problem. We go back to that philosophical fucking thought experiment. Maybe she would be better off if she didn't try to help others. And that's sort of what she becomes when she becomes no one. She gets dehumanized. The only thing that makes us human is our connection to other humans. Humans are a hive mind when you think about it. Like a human, a man is not an island, Socrates said. Hashtag, I'm 14 and this is deep. But like, it's true. Like our identities are constructed out of our social relations. And that's why, in order to stay human, Arya does need to go back for Gendry. She does need to look after Weasel. She does need to try and keep Lommy alive, because the day you stop trying to help the people around you is the day you stop being human. So Arya sees Gendry get captured. She sees the Clegane banner, and she waits, and she watches for a very long time. She's trying to be careful, she's being very vigilant, she's being very patient, and she waits for like hours just watching these Clegane people and waiting to until it's safe to leave without being seen. Silent as a shadow, she tells herself, while the God's Eye laps calmly against its shores, and she hears the howling of wolves. So she heads back to Hot Pie and Lommy, and she's like, yo, don't shit yourselves, I got it all under control. Here's the plan, we're gonna save Gendry. Gendry got captured, we're gonna save him. Easy peasy, Japanesey lemon squeezy. Here's what we're gonna do. You, me, Lommy, you haven't got enough legs. Hot Pie, you have the correct requisite number of legs. So you and me, we're gonna go in all sneaky-like, and Hot Pie, you're gonna kill one of the guards, and then I'm gonna kill one of the guards, and we're gonna save Gendry. It's gonna be great. And look, I'm going to be honest, I is being very optimistic with regards to Hot Pie's combat skills. Because, spoiler, Hot Pie is not capable of killing someone. So they try anyway. So Arya and Hot Pie, they go and they try and save Gendry. And Lommy's like, should you really do this? Maybe you should just leave Gendry behind, which is funny because, like, Gendry was just talking about leaving Lommy behind. So, like, they're all trying to be self-serving, but Arya is trying to be the altruistic one, you know? And that's why it's so fucked that she ends up in a death cult. And so, but Arya appeals to Lommy's sense of self-preservation and points out that, well, we need Gendry because without Gendry, we can't carry the wounded Lommy around. So Lommy, you're going to die if we don't save Gendry. So Lommy's like, fucking fine. Like, Arya's the only one who's got her head screwed on here. Like, all the other motherfuckers are like, man, worms are icky. But Arya's like, we need the protein. We need the gains. If we don't get the worm gains, how do we survive? That's what Arya says. Anyway, so they go on a sneaky mission. Just remember, fear cuts deeper than swords. Arya almost tries to be like a mentor to Hot Pie, like teaching her how to survive this situation, trying to up his sneak stat. But ooh, gods be good. It's hard to teach a Hot Pie how to do anything other than make hot pies. And so they're sneaking into the village, they're trying to save Gendry, Hot Pie, Arya, on a fucking duo secret mission. It's going to be great. It's a crack squad. Arya is the squad and Hot Pie is the crack. Or something like that. And yeah, spoiler, it doesn't end well. Interestingly, a crow lands on Hot Pie's back, and that startles Hot Pie and makes him say, I yield, and that's when the jig is up. And, like, interesting, right? Because if we hypothesize that the crows are indeed controlled by the old gods of the God's Eye or by Bran via skin-changing magic or whatever, did Bran make Hot Pie get captured? I mean, in season 8, Bran is like, oh, well, why do you think I came all this way? I'm Bran Stark, and I saw it all coming. I watched the entire series in advance on TiVo, so nothing was a surprise to me. I mean, it's like, you know how, like, show watchers complained about how these obnoxious book watchers were always saying through seasons 1, 2, 3, and 4, oh, well, if you read the books, you'll find that, in fact, Talisa Magier was not the wife of Robb Stark. It was actually Jane Westerling, and it was rather a different situation, based less on love and more on... Like, god fucking damn, that was annoying for those show watchers. And I think we actually got our just desserts when season 8 happened, and then Bran Stark rolled in, and then Bran Stark to us book watchers was what it was like for the show watchers to have the book watchers at them. When Bran Stark was like, I saw the press screeners in advance. And I put 500 euros on Bran Stark being king. And I made $10,000. And I'm going to use it to buy a solid gold wheelchair. Like, oh my god, that was aggravating. But my point is that it's intriguing to think about what influence the old gods might have on this story, given that there's the whole sort of time travel situation. Anyway... Crow lands on Hot Pie. Hot Pie's like, whoa, a crow. I can't handle this situation. A crow is entirely outside of my wheelhouse. And Hot Pie says, I yield. And all of the mountain's men capture Hot Pie and Arya. And Arya, of course, is defiant to the end. She draws needles. She slashes at one person. They grab her and she tries to bite. But then some bloke punches her with an ironclad fist. And Arya is... dazed, and they take Needle, which is so infuriating and so sad that the wonderful Needle that is so much of Arya's identity is stripped from her, like every other part of her identity. Like, in the next chapter at Harrenhal, like, that's all about dehumanizing and removing Arya's identity, scrubbing her, cutting her, giving her a new name, and Needle being taken away is the beginning of that. It's like initiation into a cult, and trust me, I know, I've been initiated into more than a few cults. So Arya's trying to be brave, but she is captured. And she sees her captor. It's the tallest man Arya had ever seen. A monster from one of Old Nan's stories. It's Gregor Clegane, the mountain that rides. And here's something interesting. So Arya says that Gregor's face looks as hard as if it had been cut from stone. Now, if we do a little rewind, you'll find that in book one, Bran Stark talks about, has a vision, and he sees, if I recall correctly, he sees a giant made of stone remove its helm and remove its helmet, and beneath is only black blood. And I think, you know, one speculation is that, you know, Gregor Clegane, he gets stabbed by a poison spear by Oberyn Martell, and that he gets changed by some necromancy into this zombie giant called Robert Strong, and some people suspect that maybe Robert Strong will be unmasked at Cersei Lannister's trial by combat in the next book, and her lies will be revealed to everyone, and people suspect that this vision that Bran has in book one about a giant made of stone and his visor revealing black blood might foreshadow that. And I think that is corroborated by this line where Arya says that Gregor's face looks as if it has been cut from stone. And I mean, it's very appropriate that if Gregor Clegane is the mountain, mountains are made of stone. So it makes sense that he's cut from stone, and it makes sense that his visor, you know, he's a stone giant. And so I think that supports further the idea that that Gregor will be unmasked at Cersei's trial, and there'll be black blood, and it'll be some zombification motherfuckery, and everyone will go wild. Stick that in your funkin' wagnalls. Okay, so Hot Pie is like, I yield, don't hurt me, I'll bake you pies and tarts. Which is a pretty good deal. Like, look, Hot Pie, he might not be good at fighting or stealth or anything, but he is good at bakery and he is good at commerce. And I think that offering his pie services is a wise decision at that juncture. And then the Mountain's men force them to lead them back to Lommy and lead them back to Weasel, and they do take them back. Weasel isn't there when they get there. Apparently Weasel ran off, and Arya thinks, run, Weasel. Run as far as you can. Run and hide and never come back. And to my knowledge, we never see Weasel again. And I think it would be cool if, like, Weasel comes back at the last moment to save Arya many, many books hence. You know, like a Deus Ex Weasel. If Arya's, like, about to die, and then Weasel just comes out of nowhere with a fucking great sword and just beheads five Lannisters. I think that would be a great time. You know, maybe the Night King should be defeated by a Weasel leaping out of nowhere. That'd be fun. And she's still got mud around her mouth, because it turns out that her superpower is gaining the strength of the mud from the mud people. Ooh. Anyway, so, like, the Mountain's men are like, hey, we're looking for Beric Dondarrion. Where's he at? Can you help us out? Find the old Beric boy. Find the Lightning Lord. So there's all this sort of foreshadowing about how Beric Dondarrion is this cool Brotherhood Without Banners guy before we actually meet him. And the Mountain's men come up to Lommy and they're like, huh, something wrong with your leg? And Lommy's like, yeah, nah, you're gonna have to carry me, mate. Just sling me over your shoulder. Just put me in a papoose. I've devised this ingenious papoose system. You just need to slot me in. Just slot Lommy into the Lommy papoose. And I can be carried about. Mobile. Convenient. Tactile. Rechargeable. Solar powered. I'm a convenient mobile Lommy papoose. But Gregor's men are like, fuck no. I've got enough protein from the worms. I don't need to lift any Lommies. I think you're going to stay, Lommy. I think you're going to remain. And so the Mountain's man, I'm not sure which one, maybe this is Polliver, or maybe it gets revealed later, but one of the Mountain's men kills Lommy. Carry him, he says, he muttered, chuckling. And that is the last line in the chapter. So, god fucking damn, Arya tried so hard. Arya tried so hard. All she wants to do is get a home and get safety and get a pack and get friends who she can rely on. But everything goes fucking wrong. She tries to protect Lommy. She tries to go back for Gendry. But all the leg potions in the world could not help her, because she gets captured, Lommy gets killed, she fails to save Gendry, everything goes wrong. From bad to worse, from worse to worster, from worse to worcester sauce. In the end, it doesn't even matter, says Helsius in the chat. So, goddamn, it's a disaster. And I think what's most profoundly depressing about this chapter is that, like, the lessons that it teaches Arya is that, you know, the correct answer to the Lomi problem, the trolley problem, the philosophical situation is that she would have been better off leaving Lomi, because Lomi was never going to survive, and Gendry was never going to escape. She might as well have been selfish. Maybe Tarba and Kotjak were correct, and she should have just dumped the vulnerable and looked out for herself. Maybe that's the lesson here. Because Arya's whole story turns her into an assassin. I mean, Arya's story is like the origin story of a supervillain. She's dehumanized, she's taken away from all her ethics, all her family, all her context. She turns into a murderer. A brutal, cold murderer. And we see that in the Mercy chapter in The Winds of Winter. She's a killer. And, you know, we're sympathetic to her because we've spent all this time in her head, in her chapters, but goddamn, it's dark. And I think what maybe should happen is that Arya will do some things that we will be forced to recognize are horrible, immoral acts, and then we'll have to think, well, maybe Arya isn't a good person. And hopefully Arya will find the light. Hopefully Arya will be reunited with her family and she'll, you know, reconnect with her humanity. But Arya says that, you know, she's damaged in a way that will not heal. And so I wonder if maybe Arya will sail west in the books. Because at the end of the Game of Thrones TV show, she sails west of Westeros. And it's like in The Lord of the Rings when Frodo sails west, because he's not quite whole. He's not quite entirely human. He's not quite healed from what she suffered. So maybe Arya will fail to reconnect with her humanity and she'll sail west. I don't know. So goddamn, that was a hell of a chapter. It was pretty dark. It's pretty rough, and it only really gets rougher for Arya, because she goes to Harrenhal, she gets indoctrinated, takes on a new identity, she's hanging out with the bloody Tywins and the Bruces and the Vargo Hotes of the world, and it really only gets darker from there. It gets worse before it gets better, and that's what A Song of Ice and Fire is like. Thank you so much for participating in this episode of A Song of Ice and Fire Abridged, Game of Thrones Abridged by Alt Swift X. Do subscribe to the podcast. The link is in the YouTube description. Do give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Do press the like button. Do comment. You gotta feed that algorithm, you know? Because if you don't feed that algorithm, Swifty doesn't get to eat. And if Swifty doesn't get to eat, Swifty doesn't get to burp into the mic. And if you don't do that, what are you paying for, you know? Thanks again for the super chats from Addy and Lucas. Have a good one. We'll do another episode soonish. We'll try and get these happening a bit more frequently because it is a good time. No chaotic enigma. There is not a schedule to these. It's kind of whenever it happens, but we'll try and do it more frequently because we're getting close to the 100th episode. Next episode is episode 94, so we'll try to get there. So yeah, have a good time, subscribe to the podcast, and cheers.